Welcome to Time Code Presents. Today we speak with filmmaker, programmer, curator, and all-around champion of weird cinema, Renee Broussard. Founder of the legendary Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge, if you spent any time lurking around New Orleans' underground film and art scene over the last 40 years, chances are you wandered through Zeitgeist's doors. Hosted by John Wood, we talk with Renee about building one of the South's longest-running alternative art spaces, screening the films nobody else will touch, and keeping independent art alive in New Orleans. Zeitgeist always has something for and against everyone. Here we go.
Welcome back to Time Code Presents. Today we are with Mr. Renee Broussard, founder, owner of the Zeitgeist, what are we calling it now? Because I see Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge, but I know we had a little conversation.
It started out as Zeitgeist Theater Experiments, Inc. That's a little bit bulky. And then we became the Zeitgeist Multidisciplinary Arts Center, even more. And then we decided, that's too much for people. So we just went to Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge, and people respond to that better.
And so. I remember whenever y'all moved, and it feels like it was yesterday, but it's been a bit now, huh?
Yeah, we've been in this location for, it'll be 5 years this March. March 7th, we opened here, and we were on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard before that for 19 years. Zeitgeist has been in the New Orleans area for 37 years as of last week. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do full-time film, video, performance, music, spoken word, visual art programming, occasional dance, and we're always looking for organizations to collaborate with and artists that we can work with to show their work.
And we were talking a little bit before, but how did this get started up? So was it UNO where you were starting?
Yeah, I was at the University of New Orleans, and it started, I was doing a lot of different things. I was in the drama and communications department, and was acting in countless plays, and doing some voiceover work, started directing this play called Blood in the Cat's Neck by Rainer Werner Fassbinder, one of his anti-theater plays. And the lead character was Phoebe Zeitgeist. And it got censored by the communication drama department. The night before we were supposed to open, they were sort of freaked out by the lack of costumes and the explicit sexual violence in the play, but that had all been approved by the faculty advisor. And we ended up taking it off campus and running a 3-week sold-out run as a benefit for Art Against AIDS that did really, really well. And that started at the Can-Can Cabaret at the Royal Sonesta Hotel on Bourbon Street. And then we started doing a lot of theatrical productions. And I had always been working in movie theaters. And at the time, I was the chief of staff at the Britannia Theater, which was under Landmark Theater Corporation. And I was tired of reading about all the films that wouldn't come to New Orleans, but seemed to be playing in art houses all around the country. So I worked out a deal with them to, you know, rent the films and to bring them in for on a repertory schedule. And I would donate my time making up and breaking down the films, pick up the film rental and the shipping, and then split the door with the theater, and they would get all the concessions. So there was really no way to break even with that model. But we started doing memberships, and people started making donations. We started doing a film series with the Deutsches Haus, and with we would get these mini grants from Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and we would do the citywide film series that I would curate and promote and organize. And we started getting a lot of media attention. We were getting write-ups all the time in the Times-Picayune. At the time, David Barron was the film critic, and every time he would write about us, there was some different adjective he would use to describe me, and it was always like, you know, the indefatigable, the untireable, the self, you know, the promoter, the everything. There was a different one each week, and but we were getting a lot of attention and audiences built, and we started needing our own space.
And that's interesting, because I was coming up, and my brother went to film school before I did, and I would occasionally tag along with him to the one at O.C. Haley. When did that come up? Because I remember we interviewed you, and I think it was 2003.
Well, we started out at X-Art Gallery in the Garage District at 333 Girard until that space burned down, because there was a big furniture warehouse across the street that caught on fire and burned down three buildings across the street, and X-Art was one of them. So that moved then to next to Yaya on O'Keefe, on Barone rather, 700 Barone, the big gallery storefront. We then started doing programming at the Masonic Temple building at 333 St. Charles. Not many people use it, but there's this incredible 1,300 seat Art Deco theater on the 13th floor of the Masonic Temple building. So we did programming there. We were doing things like on Monday nights at Muddy Waters, and on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, we moved over to Pussycat Caverns, this space in the Bywater at Piety Murgundy. And then we built what really was scheduled to be Theater 4 at Movie Pictures, which was this sort of, it was a second-run movie theater that, you know, where you could buy pitchers of beer and po' boys and food and sit, and they had live comedy, they had comedy gumbo and improv comedy, and they would show films for a couple of bucks after they had played at other theaters. They had a big empty space that they hadn't developed yet, so we worked out a thing to become the Zeitgeist Screening Room. In what was later to become their Cinema 4. And we showed films there on 16 millimeter and video, and worked out a deal similar like what I had done at the Britannia when I was working there, where we would, you know, pay for the rental of the films, the shipping, and then we would split the door and they would get all the concessions. And we started doing all these incredible theatrical runs, some incredibly successful runs, like Wonderful Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl, which ran for like months. And there were some really good ones that ended up, you know, picking up our expenses for a year or so of programming with what we were able to generate. And then we sort of outgrew the screening room, because what became problematic was it only had 45 seats. And there were so many people that would try to come and couldn't get in or get turned away that they would stop trying to come. And then suddenly, you know, like there's like all these empty seats because people aren't trying to come because they don't think they're going to be able to get a seat. So we needed a bigger space, and we ended up leaving Movie Pictures and found this big garage on O'Keefe that right next to Sewell Cadillac, which is now where our space was, is now part of the Whole Foods there at Girard and O'Keefe. And they tore that space down to build the big Rouse, rather, not Whole Foods, Rouse. Then we moved to the 2000 block of Magazine Street. And then Juan's Flan Burrito moved in next to us. And what people don't remember is when Juan's first moved in there, they were robbed three nights in a row that first week they opened. And then on the fourth night, of course, they had undercover cops there who actually caught the people. But yeah, I don't think I went more than like a week or two without having to call the police about something or another. But at that same time, other things started happening on that street. And if you remember back when Anne Rice was having her big feud with Al Copeland, she announced, she bought the old Happy Hour Theater right across the street from us and announced that she'd be opening the first in a series of theme restaurants called Café Lestat. And all these venture capitalists came in and bought every building on our street, including the one we were in, and we had to leave. And then she ended up not doing the project, and all these buildings that got bought for inflated prices sat empty for like, you know, 6 or 7 years, and they lost their shirts, so serves them right. And then, but then we were fortunate enough to move to Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard, which people perceived as being a dangerous neighborhood, but I was there for 19 years and only had to call the police twice in 19 years. It was a really great venue and the community, and it was part of something really amazing. You knew everybody on the street. And I shared the first space I was in, I shared with Andy Antipas with Barrister's Gallery. And Andy was kind of notorious about forgetting to lock the door when he would leave. And he would leave at like 5, and I would get there around 6. It was about an hour where nobody was there, and I would come and the door was like wide open, but nothing had been taken. And or occasionally I'd come in and like Jeffrey Cook, who lived upstairs, would be sitting there, he'd pull a chair out and he'd sit in the doorway to make sure nobody went in until we got there. And he was like, I noticed Andy forgot to lock the door, so. but then that building after Katrina, the whole building went condo. And so we ended up having to move. We moved one block over on Aretha Castle Haley. Saturn's screen printing was downstairs, but he ended up moving his screen printing business upstairs, and then we moved in downstairs. But there was like a 7-month period while he had to do renovations to make us up to code to be able to move in there. And so we did programming for 7 months at the School of Architecture building at Tulane University. And then we were back on OC Haley. So on OC Haley, a total of 19 years minus 7 months. And then we were recruited really for this arts campus that the Miro Foundation was developing on St. Claude Avenue in Araby. It's this incredible facility, and we ended up with, for the first time in our history, with a full bar, you know, like two separate venues with the Zeitgeist Theater in the back and then the lounge in the front where we could have music or spoken word or comedy events happening while films were happening in the back, or theatrical events in the back. They even have rigging in the ceiling over the stage in the theater. So we've had some, you know, burlesque and aerial acrobatics and dance productions in the theater. And then during COVID, the Miro Foundation started developing this empty lot next to us, and they've created the St. Claude Arts Park, which is a big amphitheater where we can do outdoor programming, community events, art events, private events. So that's been a real cash cow, and it's been a real opportunity for us to expand our programming even further and have some of the bigger events that, you know, we can't do in the lounge, which seats at most about 60 people, in the theater about 80. But we can have, you know, up to 500 or 600 people in the art park. And we've had, you know, literary festivals. We've had had you know, crawfish boils, and we've had some film events out in the park with silent films with original scores being performed live. We had one with 99 Hooker, this filmmaker, musician from New York. We did another with members of the Austin Symphony Orchestra performing an original score to Man with a Movie Camera by Vertov. So, you know, we've had a lot of hosting benefits for area charities, and so it's been a really important sort of addition to our canon of what we're able to do.
And that's one of the things I was fascinated by, because we had a film in Scream Fest NOLA, and the first night it was screenings in the theater, like you said, and there was an event out here.
Yeah.
And then the next day it was a screening with an event outside, like I think it was a family reunion or something, but I remember it was like a deal going on. So it kind of expands out, like you had said.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I guess my question would be, how do you program, or what do you program, or how do you go about?
Well, I mean, I'm constantly scouring. I used to go to the Toronto Film Festival every year, but up until COVID started, I haven't been back yet because they were doing too much virtual, and it didn't seem like it was worth the money and the risk to like go. But I'm hoping to go next year, start going again. But I scour the websites for all of the film festivals around the world, and whatever I'm interested in, I'm like, before they have even played in the U.S. or before they are even, you know, have a distributor, I'm like contacting producers, I'm laying the groundwork, and it's like, I'm interested in this film, or I'm, you know, very excited to have an opportunity. So when they finally get a distributor, they said, oh, and this guy from New Orleans has already contacted us, and then they contact me, and that's how I'm able to sort of get a lot of things before, you know, the bookers for the Britannia or Britannia at Canal Place or the Broad. And you know, we do a number of series, so I sort of have a lot of ins with Telefilm Canada for, you know, to find and bring things here that, even if they don't have a distributor in the U.S. yet, from Canada, for our Canada's Bigger Than the U.S. series. And then people find me, you know, it's like, I'm constantly being, sent emails from, like, just today, you know, it was like, there was this, what is it? It sounded good. This documentary that, is going to be opening in February, about Kim's Video in New York, and someone made this video, and they were like, "Oh, we're trying to find art houses for this film, and we think you'd be ideal for New Orleans." And I was like, "Yes, just tell me when, you know, because I've been to Kim's Video, I ordered from Kim's Video, you know, sign me up."
and another thing, because I think that talking to you about kind of how your take on programming everything that you're doing is that you were a filmmaker, because I actually, I think it was like episode 2 of Time Code.
Yeah.
Was it Norman Rockwell?
Never Painted a Fat Kid. That was this, y'all showed the six minute
yes,
version
yes,
of that. Because I did a series, autobiographical series of videos called The Fat Boy Chronicles, which played in over 100 gay and lesbian and documentary film festivals around the world. It has that distinction in that it only played in documentary festivals or gay and lesbian film festivals. No film festival that was just like, you know, San Francisco Film Festival or it was the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, but not the San Francisco International Film Festival. It was all showed in the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival. But, you know, it's like it never just played in, like, not even the New Orleans Film Festival, because I wouldn't let them. And because I'd rather, you know, make the money myself. And I mentioned that I had done parts one and two, and Novak was doing this series called Open City, where they gave free editing and equipment rentals to artists to make a 6-minute video for this series. They had gotten this foundation grant to do. And I said, well, I'll be happy to make a 6-minute version of, but I'm planning on making, you know, about an hour long piece to finish my trilogy, The Fat Boy Chronicles, but I'd be happy to make a special 6-minute version in exchange for you letting me also make, you know, use that time to, you know, make the version I want to make. And they said, sure. And so I was able to make my, what ended up being 47-minute film and my 6-minute film, and it cost me absolutely nothing. Completely free. And that is a big lesson I want to convey to filmmakers out there. If you make short films, you are always going to be treated badly. You're going to get invited to all these festivals, but they're never going to invite you. They'll invite your film and say, oh, yeah, if you want to come, you know, we'll try and find a couch for you, or we'll see what we can do. We'll give you a few passes to your screening, and we'll see if we can get you passes to see other films in the festival. We can get you a pass so you can rush the films that haven't sold out. And it's just like, you know, they treat you really badly. But I found when I did the Fat Boy Chronicles, festivals that had shown part one and part two and hadn't invited me wanted to show part three, but I then told them, well, no, now it's a feature, so it can only be shown as a feature. So they said, oh, well, we've already shown part one and two, so, you know, we really just want to show the new one. It's like, no, you have to show it as a feature film. And then suddenly, the same festivals are now flying me in, putting me up in a hotel, picking me up in a limo, giving me passes to the whole festival. And I'm like, okay. And picking me up in a limo for my screening, to take me to my screening. And I'm like, okay. So in other words, I was scum of the earth when I was a short filmmaker. No, good to know.
that's really funny, because one of the things we talk about is how a lot of people only make short films, and a lot of times we ask them why. I mean, because obviously creating is a huge part of it, obviously, you know, having that artistic outlet. But what you're saying is very true. I don't know how many festivals you submitted to, and it almost feels like you're just throwing money away.
Well, and I've never paid an entry fee, and I've gotten all those, because I had the luxury of, well, as a programmer, I knew all the programs. So I got in to, when I finished the first one, I sent it immediately to Frameline Film Festival, the big one in San Francisco, and to the New York Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. And I got accepted into both of them. And there's kind of a tragic story around that, because I submitted it to the programmer, who was a friend, from the San Francisco Film Festival. I'd always talked to him over the phone. I'd never met him in person, but what he did was he had contracted AIDS, and he programmed the entire festival and then sent out the acceptance letters to everyone and the rejection letters, and then went to the Golden Gate Bridge and committed suicide. So by the time I had gotten my letter telling me I was at the festival, and I would call him to thank him, and I find out he's dead. and I was in Berlin at the time when on an artist fellowship. Guest curating at Eisenal, the main Cinematheque in Berlin. And it was very, very sad.
So you had mentioned not paying fees. It's because of the...
Well, yeah, because it's a genre festival, and there are other genres, you know, like gay and lesbian film festivals all around the world. They would wait and see what's being shown at the San Francisco or the New York gay and lesbian film festivals, and then they would see what they're interested in, and they would flood you with an invitation to submit your film to their festival. So suddenly you're getting invited to like a gay and lesbian film festival in Estonia or Iceland or Tokyo or London or Paris and all around the world. You know, if they invite you, you don't have to pay an entry fee. Now, there isn't that same equivalent with, you know, like regular festivals, unless it's one of the major ones like Sundance or Toronto. So I don't know what advice to offer people in just like a shorts festival.
Well,
if you have a generic, you know, narrative short, how to get around the crippling entry fee.
Well, the advice you can give people, though, is from your stance as a programmer, as far as trying to get into, because you run kind of an art house along with some of the other venues we talked about.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker that, you know, they do a feature, like we made an independent feature, that's trying to find theatrical. How would they go about trying to get into someplace like this?
Someplace like Zeitgeist?
Yes.
All they have to do is contact me with an email or calling me on the phone, because we're looking for films to program, you know, 360 days out of the year. And, you know, we're trying to find films that, you know, people haven't already necessarily heard of. New talent, you know, part of our mission is to support emerging young filmmakers, you know, so that's what we're looking for. And, you know, we're not looking for, you know, like, it doesn't have to be, you know, a specific subject matter or genre. It just has to be, you know, something that we haven't seen. Like, I'm not looking to program, you know, like another formulaic Hallmark movie or something, you know. You know, anything that has any originality, you know, we'll program it.
And you had talked before about one of the things that you get your movies from, the movies that'll do AMC in New York and L.A., and then if they just don't do well there, a lot of times, then it opens up for y'all to take it over.
Yeah, and that happens a lot, more so before COVID happened, but that happens a lot over the summertime as well, because you have, like, the summer blockbuster effect, where you still have art house films being released throughout the summer, but you have the theaters that get committed to, you know, like, we got to do 8 weeks in order to get this big blockbuster, and oh, we got to do, admit to, you know, commit to 4 weeks with this one, and it takes up all of their screens, and, you know, they no room to play art house over the summertime, even though places like the Broad that would usually be art house heavy are, you know, the upper tier art house films over the summertime, I'm going to be playing them because nobody else has room for them, because they're committed to, you know, A24 and Neon and all these, you know, upper tier films. I'm getting, you know, the ones that I wouldn't usually get any other time of the year.
Well, and speaking of ones that you don't usually get, one of the things I found was interesting, you talked about Triple Xmas. And how people still think that y'all are a bit of a lewd theater because of things like that, which is funny because it's one of those ones that I never realized people had that connotation. But is it Guardians of the Flame, correct? That's the Jonathan Demme one?
January 2nd, members of the Guardians of the Flame were looking for a venue. They approached me looking for a venue to have an evening showcasing they're going to show three films, two of which people have already had an opportunity to see. They're going to show those, and they are going to premiere the rough edit of a documentary that Jonathan Demme was worked on for about 3.5 years prior to his death, and nobody's really seen it. And they're going to have a free screening of these three films the night of Tuesday, which is an odd night, but that's the night they wanted, Tuesday, January 2nd. And they're going to have, you know, of course, they're handling the how to get tickets for that, you know, with they're going to be doing probably an Eventbrite thing where you have to log in to get the free tickets. But I'm pretty sure it's going to sell out because they know we have 80 seats.
Well, and whenever people are trying to, what do you look at for programming? Because I know that we had talked, we had a couple of Oscar nominee or Oscar submissions from different states here. Do they usually come to you, or how do you usually try to program with them?
What happens is we show a lot of like official entries for the Oscars. We just showed two of them back to back. We just showed the official Academy Award entry from Switzerland for Daughters. And we had maybe 20 people the entire week come to see it. And that's often a problem, is like we show a film before anybody else around the country, and then it just won last night the Gotham Award for Best Documentary, and now it's like becoming a kind of a front runner for, you know, nominations with the Golden Globes and the Oscars, but we've already shown it, you know. and then we also showed the official that's the official film entry from Tunisia. And then we just showed Thunder, the official Academy Award entry from Switzerland, which did better, but, you know, it's like gotten any nominations yet, but, it could. And then, you know, it's like...
Well, how do you balance that? Because that's, I didn't even think about that, getting something too early.
Well, that happens to me all the time. It's like, you know, that happened to me with, like, Moonlight. That happened to me, as I said, we had Barry Jenkins here. What was cool was the night we had Barry Jenkins at Zeitgeist, when we were on Aretha Kessel Haley with his first film, Medicine for Melancholy. He completely surprised me. He's doing the Q&A with the audience, and he says, I hate to do this, but you know, this audience has been so great. Renee, where's Renee? And I raised him. He says, would it be possible to show a short film that I've just completed it in the hotel room today, and it's a film I made about my mother. No one's seen it yet, and I'd like to get some feedback before I submit it to some festivals. He's like, would you? So I was like, there's an audience there. I was like, I wish you would have mentioned it earlier. It's like, what format is it on? What? And well, it'll take about 5 minutes to hook up a laptop. And he showed this short film that he had made about his mother. That was incredible. The audience is like weeping and applauding. It's like, I don't know what ever happened with that film. If it ever even got released, or if it's going to be like a feature down the road. Because his next project was Moonlight, and we showed it. Everybody showed it. We were showing it when it won the Oscar, because most people dropped it. But I was like, this is going to win. This is going to win. And then when they said La La Land, I was so like, oh, damn. I was like the happiest person imaginable when it was the wrong film. And because we still had it. And then the problem was we were the only theater that was still playing it when it actually won. And then the week after it won, it's like practically nobody came to Zeitgeist because it was at every theater.
That's why. Yeah. I guess that's part of the kind of ebb and flow. But I mean, it's crazy. I never even thought about that, getting too far ahead of something. Because there's a lot of things I've seen y'all show. But cripes, it was around.
We've had a lot of films that we've shown that have gone on to win Oscars or, you know, down the road. And a lot of filmmakers that we've had that have gone on to become, you know, big filmmakers, and, you know, before they're big.
It's interesting the way that y'all actually, the programming that y'all have, because it also doesn't seem like there's any rhyme or reason to some of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, we never really want people to know what to expect from us, you know, because the moment somebody thinks they know what our programming is like, you know, it's like then we're kind of tired. So I always want to shock people by having something they wouldn't expect.
Well, and if people are looking for y'all, because we had a chat before, but you couldn't get the Zeitgeist domain.
Oh, well, luckily, I mean, we're on all of the movie listings. You know, you can buy advance tickets to all of our films at Fandango, for God's sakes. You know, so we're now on all the online movie listings. So, but even then, I often have problems because a lot of the films that I show aren't in their system. So they'll say that we're showing it, but it'll only list a title. It won't list, you know, like any other information. It won't have a movie poster. It'll just be like, you know, because, we didn't have anything to connect it to in our system. You know, it's like, so, because that's when you know your film is really small.
Well, and y'all, so there's actually also a bar here, because I know this is the lounge starting to fill up a little bit right
yeah.
now. Are you able to come in here and just actually have a drink at the end of the day?
Sure.
So it's not just coming in here for a theater.
Well, we're only open around our programming. So we open up an hour before the first screening. And then, you know, we close when the movie ends, you know. So, you know, if we have the movie ends at 10:15, we close at 10:15. The movie, you know, unless people want to are here in here drinking or something, we'll stay open. But, you know, it's like, you know, we're not, I guess it'd be nice to be a destination bar. But we're kind of... I'm the worst person to possibly, or maybe the best person to possibly own a bar, because I never wanted to. I've never thought about having a bar. I haven't had alcohol since 1984. I have no frame of reference. I mean, I've never had gin in my life. I've never had, you know, I've never had Jägermeister. I've never had, you know, any. So people ask me about all these drinks, and I know nothing about them. That's why for tonight I've got bartenders coming in to work the wrap party. But, you know, it's like drinking isn't part of my thing, and which is a little ironic, because if people will remember, I mean, this is dating me because I'm 59. So when I was younger, the drinking age in New Orleans was 15. So I started drinking when I was 15, you know, going out to bars and seeing bands and hanging out before I could even drive. And, you know, I'm constantly going to see bands. I started my freshman year of college. You know, it's like I'm going out with friends all the time to see music. And one person would buy a round of drinks, another would buy a round of drinks, another would buy a round of drinks. And when it's your turn, you buy a round of drinks and you spend like $80, $90. And you're going like, well, I'm working minimum wage trying to put myself through college. And it's like, I can't afford this. So I just, pure economics, I just... Like in the middle of my freshman year, I just decided to stop drinking. I stopped allowing people to buy me a drink when we would go out. And then I could just buy a couple of Diet Cokes and spend $2 instead. And I was able to put myself through college, you know, by not drinking. Well, UNO was $360 a semester, and then plus books, you know, but yeah.
So where can people find you if they're looking for you? You have a website, you have social media.
Yeah, it's zeitgeistnola.org, zeitgeistnola.org, or they can call us at 504-352-1150. And our listings are on all of the online movie listings. You can buy advance tickets to any of our events on our website through VZ or through Fandango.
This is Renee Broussard, John Wood. Thank you again for coming in. Zeitgeist, go check it out.
Timecode Presents is produced by Ricardo Barros and hosted by John Wood. Special thanks to our guest, Renee Broussard. If you're in New Orleans, head down St. Claude to Araby. Do yourself a favor and check out what's happening at Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge. They've been championing independent film, performance, and alternative art since 1986, and they're still at it. Support your local weird cinema. If you want to stay up on what we're doing at Timecode, head over to timecodenola.com or just ask somebody. Later.